I've had this conversation with our teams quite often, and I lean heavily on the idea that no one is coming to help us. There isn't some amazing hire that I'm going to make or some deal that's going to fall in our lap that's going to save all of us and then we can just coast. No, this is about growing these capacities so that we can seek to grow and evolve the industries in which we're nested, which aligns with our corporate direction, right? Because really it's up to us. And so we work on these in the context of actual work to grow our capabilities and our offerings to clients. Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we have a request. We're looking for you, our dear listener, to send us articles in business journals or journals on business or organizational conduct and design. And by the way, please no government or policy or politics or issue-based articles. We don't do those. Because ultimately, we want to use our frameworks for critique and offer a regenerative and developmental alternative. So please send these to Carol at carolsanford.com. So, you know, we take on each of these requests very seriously. And if we feel we have something new to offer, and maybe we haven't covered it before extensively, we'll take it on. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, as you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn how to work more closely with us or join a multi-organization business team or change agent community, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So our topic today, the Great Resignation, as it's been dubbed, has so many interpreters shouting that they know what's happening in the news for about the past 2 years now, and it actually shows no sign of slowing down. So on a personal note, during my late 20s, I had my great resignation from Wall Street, and I think at the time I felt like I'd lived the first 30 or so years of my life for someone else. And at that point, it was high time I figured out what I wanted to actually do with the rest of my life. So after 10 years of misfires, I found it super alloy. But I think, Carol, I guess I'm curious, like in general, why are we taking the subject on?
Well, I have a kind of personal take on it also, not in my 20s, but I have a grandson who graduated from college last year. And he has his first job, big deal, woohoo, right? And he's not excited. He's a good student, graduated top of his class, always great grades, great salary in tech, and he's bored. And he's already thinking what matters, and when I ask him, you know, how he feels and why about his job, he says, well, you know, you get the money and then I can go do something else. And we talk every Monday night, you know, grandma to grandson. And I do a lot of running also communities, of which you've been a part of one of. And we've had so many new people joining in the last 2-3 years, all of which are the new ones. Maybe 60% of them are under 35 years old. And a huge number of them have left jobs and done their own startup or some radical revision of how they do their lives. So all this feels really close to my heart, and I have some opinions on it. So Zach, we, as always, use an article, and you're good at sharing what that's all about, the key lessons that are in it, and giving people a sense of it so they know what we're reacting to. You up for getting us started?
Sure, absolutely. So we're, again, giving HBR a little bit of a break. And so this article is, again, from the MIT Sloan Review. And it's entitled, Toxic Culture is Driving the Great Resignation, by Donald and Charles Sull and Ben Zweig from January 11th, 2022. And so in their research, they discovered that the top 5 predictors of attrition and the 4 actions managers can take to reduce that attrition are really what was kind of the thrust of the whole thing for them. And so I wanted to start first with the predictors. So there are 5 of them, and they go like this. Number 1, toxic corporate culture. Number 2, job insecurity and reorganization. Number three, high levels of innovation. Number four, failure to recognize employee performance. And number five, a poor response to COVID-19. And so the analytic process that the authors went through was really threefold with this analysis. So first they looked at demographics, white collar versus blue collar. And they looked at average industry turnover against the selected companies. And then third, they compared companies in the Culture 500 index against high performing and well-known companies not in that index. And so, as many of our longtime listeners will know or may have guessed, we've railed against the flaws in approaches like this, right? In demographics and assuming humans can kind of work and be thought of as averaged or in averages, and the belief that algorithms are infallible to human influence. And so, by way of a quick note, actually, as I was reading this, I looked up the Culture 500 and their analytical process for how they determine their rating and ranking system, which is really all about analyzing a bunch of reviews on Glassdoor. And so, as I was thinking about it, it's just because someone wrote something on Glassdoor doesn't mean that it's true or valid as a data set, right? Like, I think I've written two Google reviews in my life. And one of them was because I was asked to help a fledgling business. And the other was because I was super upset with the treatment in a bike shop. To assume that these were both free of bias and valid for data would be a pretty horrible miscalculation, I think. But Carol, beyond the surface level issues with this approach, what do you think were maybe the class one errors that underlie it?
Well, we know already the nature of surveys, and you're pointing to a bit of it. One of the things that they don't speak to is how shallow these responses are. So I first would be questioning why these things, these don't seem to have anything to do with when you're not surveying and just talking to people. They're missing a sense of belonging, a sense of being a part of something creative and making a difference. And none of that is in this unless they're lumping it all into corporate culture, which they don't do a good job of describing. But I think the thing that I notice, and that's because I'm a lot older than you, is this set of responses with slight modifications has been the same kind of thing that's been tracked for decades is making or is missing for people. And I mean, since the Industrial Revolution, and they always show up, particularly you get this kind of quote, great resignation, the minute you have a huge destabilizing event, some uncertainty, some change, like a big recession or war, or of course, in our case, a combination of pandemic, climate change, war. All of these things make people really ask, what does really matter? So I think it's worth taking a look at, given that their survey isn't very meaningful in all the ways you talked about and I added. Let's look at what they suggest to cure it, see if there's anything better there.
Sure. So they offer, as they call it, and this is a direct quote, four short-term solutions to increase retention. So I'll hold my applause. Okay, so they are lateral career opportunities, remote work arrangements, company-sponsored social events, and offering predictable schedules. So we've talked at length before about amelioration and satisficing on the pod. And so what does that mean, though? So it means to make something less bad by finding a quick, good enough solution that absolutely has zero to do with the root cause of what's going on. And no attempt to even begin to look at that. So these are Band-Aid solutions, in other words, right? And so in general, the first two solutions are industrialized ways of approaching humans, right? So if the cog isn't working in this part of the machine, maybe we grease it and move it somewhere else. The third is behaviorally sourced, right? Because this is about rewards and perks and all these other kind of things they try to do to entice people to stay. And the fourth, again, is also primarily industrial, but another part of it is more kind of about making people find homeostasis in their behavior. So hopefully, ultimately leading to predictability of output. And it's funny how none of these talk about development, growth, connection to customers, to the business, to the industry, to having individuals connected to the industry. No, this conversation is really about arresting disorder here, Carol. And it's written in a way that it's really fed by the fear that's arisen from a new pattern of behavior that people can't understand from this, as you say, destabilizing force.
I look at, again, this entire article makes me sad because it's so superficial. It's close to being meaningless. And why in the world would you put it in a journal that is giving advice to leaders of some sort? And as I said, some of the first studies that I know about were called the Hawthorne study and others that had to do with happiness. And not that those are not worth thinking about, but what you do when you do a survey is you get people saying something they think you can do something about. They've handed it off to you and they assume that you're going to fix it, and then they do nothing. So what's really the problem with all this whole culture surveys, satisfaction surveys, is they don't involve people in changing what they're doing. In other words, there's no personal agency engaged. So I think it would help if we, in offering our alternatives, we lay out three things that are missing from what they're talking about and that are necessary. I've been working with my grandson on these, and I can tell how he comes to life when we talk about essence expression, him getting to bring something that only he can bring, not just his brilliant high-speed coding and work on leading and teaching some other people, but something only he can do. And we've been playing with that whole idea, and I can feel him light up. Secondly, there's no in any of their solutions the idea that people have a human capacity they want to develop. I mean, Max, my grandson, graduated from college, you know, top of his class. And so he's been hired based on that. But now what? He doesn't want to quit growing, quit learning. And he finds himself online watching YouTube channels on how to get better at a question he has. But it's more like a reactive, I'm trying to figure out how to entertain myself. So how do we develop the human capacity? And the third thing, which is missing everywhere, is that we design work so that we make work without essence, without human development, and without a way to initiate and bring all that to bear. So let's offer some things here that can really shift the culture, really bring more innovation in, and understand how meaningful life actually happens.
Sure. So let's start with essence expression, as Carol said. So what is it and why are we proposing it? So we discussed this a little bit in our last episode, but it's the idea that instead of categorizing people through abstract averages or demographics or some surface level characteristic, we seek to actually look at each individual as a one of one, as Carol said with her grandson, each with their own way in which they're seeking to contribute. And each person has a way in which they engage with the world, searching to try to offer that what's core to them, and connect it to something that's larger and has a more meaningful kind of opening in a system potentially to change something. This often lies nascent without developing the capacity to do so.
And you know, you don't have to actually go engage each person in discovering their essence. You can do that by looking at what the essence of the business is, because people come to work in a place or they create their own business as well, based on who they are. Like in South Africa, one of the things we looked at was the place we were in, Boksburg, Johannesburg, in that region, had been the birthplace of evolution. The move to a Homo sapien could have transitioned to that point. And that's still being studied, but it looks like it's a birthing place. So we asked people, in order to awaken what their essence was, what attracted to them to working at Colgate, where we were, and what attracted them to staying in the Boksburg, Johannesburg location. What came out of that conversation, and people digging deeper and deeper over time, was their essence was resonating with whatever birthing meant to them. And they began to birth ideas and ways of doing things and innovation. And it was a way to work on the expression of essence. Mostly what we do is delegate. Somebody at the top decides what we're going to do without ever discussing essence, assigns it to people in a generic way as though there's no distinctiveness among individuals. If you can't have each individual bring something that nobody else can bring into the operation, they will be bored because they can't express their essence and they'll find someplace else to do it.
Yeah, so at Super Alloy, we're constantly seeking to see how our essence as a company reflects and matches those of the individuals within, right? And what's more is how each of us as individuals matches that offering or the offerings that we have and delivers on them. But this doesn't happen without ongoing shared and individual reflection. And so what I've noticed actually is that everyone on our team is continually kind of reevaluating how they're working and thinking relative to a new client or an existing client or project. And people as a result are drawn to working with us because of how we work on these projects. And the clients and projects are then also drawn to us through that process. And so it turns out that like while other companies are struggling to keep people, I'm actually hiring.
Wow. I love it. That's fabulous. So let's talk a bit about where this theory of essence comes from and having people apply it. There are ancient sources and modern sources. So the ancient sources are in lineage traditions where people come to an ashram or a study group or a sangha or something, and each person is taught to watch their own mind. They're not told that there are generic ways to do things. They have, over the years, proven that if people can really come to see their own working of their own being, their own behavior, in that process, it transforms their ability to be in the world. In modern culture, you can find some of it, although it goes, some of the solutions, like the ones we see in the articles here, are not on point. But it's in a theory base called self-determination theory. And it means if people can be more self-determining about their life, and that doesn't mean independent of the culture they live in and self-centered, solipsistic way, but see themselves in a context and understand how they can contribute, it can make a huge difference to their ability to join, to feel part of something, to make a difference. So there are theory bases for this everywhere. And of course, we work on much of this in our work if people want to know more about that. All right, so Zach, that's kind of a summary of the essence expression. I think the second area is looking at the three human capacities, which I did a lot on in the regenerative business and no more feedback. How about if you give people a bit of a taste of that?
Sure. So what are these three human capacities? So they are locus of control, external considering, and personal purposeful agency. So locus of control is the idea that I'm in control of my life, or you're in control of your life. And we can see it. I guess the easy way to see it is looking at it kind of the opposite quite easily. We see it, I think, in others quite often, where, and maybe ourselves, if we've done a bit of work on ourselves, but it's like when you see someone who's kind of victimized by the world around them. And I know that I feel this in myself as well. And this is what we call external locus of control, where everything always seems to kind of be happening to us. But in our work, we seek to build internal locus of control, which is really the foundation of personal responsibility. And so to balance that, we seek to build a capacity called external considering, which is the idea that we can see and care for individuals and entities in the world around us. And really, this is kind of a balancing force against the ego of locus of control. And so what is personal agency then? But personal agency is the idea that not only am I responsible for my actions and thoughts, but now I can connect that caring to the world around me and act as agent in carrying this out in a way that's anchored to a way of being where the buck stops with me.
Yeah, this is such important work, and I think it's core to why young people particularly are lost. We don't teach what you just said in the world, except by accident. In our work, and what we believe is the or certainly a great door to work on people feeling unhappy with their work and meaningless, is to find ways for them to really, well, to put together a couple of things. One is their ability to activate a change. So I said to my grandson the other day, given what you're designing and that there are, you're B2B, there are other companies using what you're using to decide how to do their businesses, how does what you personally do affect their ability to do that? And he looks at me, we're on Zoom, but he looks at me and he says, I don't know. And I said, well, how do you know what to work on, whether it's the right thing? He said, well, I take answers from my boss. I said, well, what would happen if you were to start connecting with real customers, either ask them to take you, or in some places you can go be publicly connected without them knowing who you are and understand their life, what it is they need, how it works. And again, he lit up and he said, wow, that would make it a lot easier and maybe I'd care more. But mostly I'd probably, they're asking me to come up with ideas how to improve it. I said, yeah, it's hard to improve something unless you know how it's going to affect them and how you can support them. But so he decided immediately he was going to go do that on Tuesday. That was earlier this week. But the other thing you have to do is have ongoing development of these kind of things, of what they look like, how to apply them. And in every company we work with and are part of our communities, they have weekly or biweekly events where there's development for a few hours, you know, 2 to 3 hours. And you'd think this would then take up time so they can't get their job done. But they all say, well, it's interesting how when I get to go learn and think and innovate and come up with my own thoughts about how I could make a difference, I can get the other stuff done in a lot less time than I thought because my energy, my will is so high. So in order for these three, the human capacities to actually come alive, because they're not in most places, they're underground and you get people feeling a victim, as you said, and they feel like they're only worried about how it affects them, the internal considering, and they follow the boss's guidance rather than having personal agencies. So that's the process, how you can move it all.
So at Super Alloy, I've had this conversation with our teams quite often, and I lean heavily on the idea that no one is coming to help us. There isn't some amazing hire that I'm going to make or some deal that's going to fall in our lap that's going to save all of us and then we can just coast. No, this is about growing these capacities so that we can seek to grow and evolve the industries in which we're nested, which aligns with our corporate direction, right? Because really it's up to us. And so we work on these in the context of actual work to grow our capabilities and our offerings to clients.
You know, I like that you're a new company and are experimenting. Every time I listen to you, I think if we could get all new companies to start this way, it'd make so much difference. But anyway, let's again talk about the theory base. We're trying to do that with each of these three. So we know that from our own experience and from research that's done shows that people who feel like they belong and are part of something have much more motivation, more will. They need autonomy in it, but they need to be a part of something. And so this idea of being nested is a part of the theory base we use here, where if you're working from external considering, it gets the mind to pay attention to the effect we're having in the reciprocity. And also, it teaches us that everything we do is affecting it, not just feeling like we're at the mercy of it. So the idea of living systems theory, the more that's being brought forward, the more it's waking us up to we are a living entity nested in something, usually at least a family. And when we're not, we can feel that loss. In neighborhoods and communities, as a part of evaluating processes where people are seeking to do something. And our real challenge here, and why the work on self-observing and self-remembering, is not to get identified with any aspect of that environment we're talking about and choose one group against another, but to see the whole is working together. And that theory base in living systems is core that needs to be brought into our work. So, Zach, take us to our third and last, which is looking at more about what causes, I think, work and job fulfillment. Right now, we don't think about it. It looks invisible to us, but all businesses, all organizations, all families, any kind of institutionalized thing has an infrastructure that's invisible. For the most part, it's an authoritarian infrastructure, even if it's a bit benevolent, although many of them are not. So we have hierarchies of reporting, things we give status to, ways of people get work assigned, how we design work. All of that is in the Western world pretty much looks alike right now. And what we have to work on is redesigning that. Now, there's some principles that are important here. And let me share the principles. One is that you need a non-competitive hierarchy that's based on ableness to contribute rather than power and education and things that aren't related to the world we're seeking to be a part of. So I've worked with companies for a long time that have this non-competitive process. And what that means is if there isn't a hierarchy where two people or three or five compete to go to the next level where there are fewer power positions, but everyone can go straight to the top, 100% of people, because the work they're doing and the hierarchy is based on making the lives of customers, consumers, members, citizens, work in a way that's whole for all of them. That's a radically different way to think about infrastructure than who reports to who and who gets promoted and who gets paid the most.
Yeah, so this is relevant. So I just had this conversation with someone, with one of my colleagues, and he was struggling with another one of our team members on some deliverables. And so I asked him what his frustration was about. And he told me, he said, "Oh, I thought you were going to handle disciplining him." And I asked him, I was like, where'd you get that idea? And after some thought and some reflection and inquiry, he realized it was an old idea that he had brought from another company.
Yeah.
And so I asked him, "Well, how well did that work for you in the past?" And he was like, "Well, terrible." He was like, "I could never have conversations with anyone who actually wanted to, and I never got anything done." And so he ended up having a conversation that was really about growth with his colleague. And then they were off and running again in like 15, 20 minutes. And so, but I think without this kind of developmental infrastructure, this kind of conversation, I think is like times 2, 3, 4, 10, 100 is the kind of thing that leads to bitterness and resentment and ultimately attrition.
I think there's a way to talk about with the principle I'm talking about of non-hierarchical, like your example, that is very helpful, which is, each person takes on I call them promise beyond ableness. And it doesn't mean I'm just doing something I don't know how to do. It means I promise a customer in their context to make their world work better. And I make that explicit. And then here's the key. I am responsible for the entire flow from that moment that promise is made or even being thought about to the time it's completed. So I call it like, they're responsible for the ideation, for the initiation, for the implementation, and for the evaluation. We usually divide up those things, and evaluation is by higher ups, initiation is by upstream, by some other department, initiation is by a supervisor or who delegates and hands it to you, and you get to implement. So the theory base here is of this particular one, and a part of the action work is to stop fragmenting, no longer having things broken up in pieces, but have infrastructure that has everyone working from beginning to end of an idea. We did this in South Africa where, and I'll tell an example I haven't ever told on this podcast. We had a guy whose Western name was Michael. I couldn't say his Zulu name. He had an idea about packaging, and Consol was a major packaging supplier, and they were in our meetings. And the infrastructure we had gave space for every person to commit to some promise. And so Michael committed to the consumers, particularly people who were buying their products inside Colgate, that the packaging would have no absorbability into any product. And that was not even remotely the case. There was plastics of various kinds and metals, which we were beginning, and Michael was beginning to see, could be absorbed into toothpaste and deodorant and personal care products. And at that point, they weren't very well tracked at all in South Africa. So Michael, because the infrastructure said each person can go to the top, each of you create what you think would make a difference to a specific user, consumer, or in some cases, we had people doing also things with suppliers. But you commit to making that, and you can therefore increase your pay. You can increase your role because there are no job hierarchies. All the infrastructure now has supervisors who are not removed, which is usual, but their role became that of resources. That is such a different theory and practice of a way to bring about life. And I told Max that story, and I said, what would it be like if you were in a job like that? And he said, well, I guess, especially in South Africa at that time, it would have been really meaningful. And I did several other stories, and I said, so why don't you create a company that does that? He said, wow, I think that's a little ahead of me. I said, well, we'll get back to it then. So that's kind of how I think. You have any summary on this article you'd like to make?
No, I mean, I think overall on reflection, I mean, I feel like we've offered some good solutions here. And I think as per our promise at the beginning of the show, if people want to learn how, you know, more about how they can do this with us, do you want to tee up some things that we have coming up?
Yes, we have two summits each year, which are publicly open with some conditions. We have one on August 12th this year. That's our seed summit. And it's called partnering developmentally or regeneratively. And that can be life partners or it can be business partners. And you can find out more about it on the website under SEED, SEED-communities.com, and look under regenerative partnering. And if you and a partner in life or in work or sometimes both want to learn how principles of regeneration and creating all the kind of things we talk about here, applying to businesses, how they apply in partnerships, there's more info there and a way to get questions answered. The second summit is our business summit for business teams, and not open to consultants, but open to executive teams running a non-consulting or non-OD consulting business. And it's going to be focusing on the newest and most urgent idea about social responsibility, which is what's the role of business in democracy and how we have to change how we work inside of a company, not so we work directly on democracy, but so we indirectly change how we have infrastructure and work. Not that it's about voting, but it's about using intelligence to be able to help our democracy work by making it work in companies.
We actually have a new community for parents and couples, family pods organized around the same children, and community pods of multiple family pods on applying the regenerative principles to familying and bringing communities of families together. You can find out more at seed-communities.com. /regenerative-parent.
And the last thing I'd invite you to is my newest book, number one, Amazon bestseller. I thank you for letting me continue to say that. I'm still so shocked. That it has book clubs, it has bonuses. If you buy even one book, you can send me a purchase or a sale agreement, and you can get a bonus. Go look on carolsanford.com under books, and then under indirect work, and you'll learn more about what the opportunities are. If the dates have passed, not to worry, they're all recorded.
And remember to send us your Business Journal articles, as this has been Business Second Opinion.